today's lecture is on building model-driven decision support systems. For many years, the most common decision support systems were all model-driven. Throughout most of the 1970s, we had some data-driven decision support systems, but they had very small databases. And we had an increasing number of model-driven DSS that were linked to either simulation or optimization or algebraic models. Today, many of the model-driven systems that we built in the 70s and 80s are legacy applications that need to be replaced. We started replacing some of those with web-based applications, but there's still lots of opportunities to update model-driven decision support systems. The idea is that a quantitative model, and that's what we're talking about in Chapter 10, is quantitative models, help us understand business problems. When we do cost estimation, the basic model is that the bid amount is equal to the cost of materials plus the cost of labor plus the cost of overhead plus the profit that we allocate to it. So our bid amount is that algebraic model, that aggregation of cost elements. When the model component, the quantitative model, dominates the DSS design and provides the functionality, we call that system a model-driven DSS. We may bring data from a database. We may have documents produced like a bid, but the functionality comes from the fact that we have a quantitative model that we can do what-if and sensitivity analysis with. Model-driven DSS almost always have some functionality associated with manipulating parameters, which we call what-if analysis, and looking at a range of outcomes given different assumptions, which is what sensitivity analysis does. Models produce results, so we want to look at how the model takes our input values and transforms them into a result. When we look at a cost estimation decision support system, the result is the bid and the elements that go into the bid sheet. We hope that models in a model-driven DSS are manipulated directly by an expert, by a manager. It may be that the model is manipulated by a pricing analyst at an airline. It may be that someone who does forecasting for supply chain manipulates the model-driven DSS, or a bid specialist for a construction company manipulates the model-driven DSS. We have a lot of different types of software that we can use for creating models. It may be specific packages for doing linear programming or probabilistic simulation. We may use more generalized tools like Microsoft Excel. But we have a variety of development environments for building model-driven DSS. If you look at slide 3, you'll see that it summarizes a number of tools: statistical packages, quantitative forecasting packages, modeling packages, and then end-user tools like at Microsoft Excel. The process is similar to any design process for a DSS. We want to identify the problem and analyze the elements in the situation. But then we need to identify the variables and the relationships among the variables. If the variables involve optimization, that leads us usually to an optimization model like linear programming. If the variables involve some uncertainty, we get led oftentimes to simulation. If the variables are more causal, then we tend to move towards an algebraic model that shows us the relationship among the variables in the situation. Once we've identified a possible model, we need to ask how appropriate and understandable it is. The worst thing is if we create an elaborate model that the user does not understand. If the model is too much of a black box, then the users won't have any confidence in it, and it will fall to disuse as soon as the results are not very good. So you want your model to be understandable. That's why, generally, with cost estimation, you're better off to use enumeration, because that's easy to understand, than a formulaic approach. If the formula is too complex or hidden from the user, then it will be hard to persuade them to use the formula. So if you use a formulaic approach, make sure that the formula is understandable and that the mathematics makes sense to a non-mathematical user. Then we have to ask how valid the model is. Generally, if our model involves lots of components that we add up, then we can see some face validity. If we have multiplication, it's pretty easy. When we start using fractions or decimals and percents in our models, it becomes a little harder for us to establish the face validity of the model. So we have to be careful with complexity in our quantitative models. Anytime we develop a model, we make assumptions. The assumptions have to have some truth behind them, or the people will question the assumptions that we use for our model. So we want to do everything we can to establish the truth of our assumptions, and we want to make those assumptions clear to the users of the system. Our model may be static, that is, we don't assume that we're estimating over time or that we're looking at some results over time. We look at a snapshot. We're applying the model in one time period. That's what a static model is, rather than dynamic, where we're trying to look at how something changes over a month or a year or 10 years. Forecasting tends to be either a point estimate for 1 year from now or 5 years from now, but sometimes we do forecasting year by year and we add more dynamic elements to the forecast. Sometimes we do that for other kinds of cost estimating too. If we cannot assume certainty, that is, that we know all the information about the model parameters, then we're more likely to assume risk. Risk just means that we have probabilistic estimates attached to model parameters. And when we assume risk, we tend to look at more complex tools like simulation to give us some idea of how much risk is associated with our estimation. Models give us estimates of outcomes. When we build a model, we need to look at the conditions and make appropriate assumptions. As I said, with certainty, then we can try to find optimal solutions. So if we're going to do linear programming or work with algebraic models, we're usually assuming some certainty. If we're assuming risk, we transform an algebraic model into a probabilistic model. That is, some of the parameters in the model take on uncertainty or risk. We attach a probability distribution to those values. The chapter goes over types of models. An explanatory model helps us see what happens in the situation. It's not necessarily very good for decision support. Algebraic models are predictive, and we try to show relationships. The most common model we use in model-driven DSS is an algebraic model. And we tend to use simple mathematical operators like addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division. We don't usually use exponents and try to have complex models like square roots or any complexity in the relationship. So we try to use fairly simple algebraic models if we can. Linear models are better than curvilinear models if they fit the situation. A specific model-driven DSS may and often does include multiple models. So if what we're trying to do is look at costs for new construction. We might have some kind of a regression model that identifies relationships. We may have a financial model of an income statement, and then we may do some optimization for the parameters in our model. So our model has to tie together, our big model, our DSS, has to tie together the smaller models that make up some of the elements of our decision support system. We take the output from one and it becomes input to another model. Let me try to give you an example there to make it a little more concrete. Let's say, for example, that we are trying to figure out how much of a loan to give for a construction company that's building a new hotel. So one thing we do is we're going to estimate occupancy. So we have a regression model and we have some information on occupancy on new hotels, and we come up with an occupancy rate of 80% that we're projecting for this new hotel. And then we have an income statement for this hotel property for a year. So we'll take that occupancy rate and use it to create an estimate of revenue for the hotel, and then we'll have some cost elements in the income statement based on other hotel properties. And then what we're going to do is try to use perhaps a linear programming model to optimize what we should charge for different room types so that we generate enough income based on occupancy to cover the loan amount and the interest. And we see how likely it is that we will do that given some sensitivity analysis for that construction loan model. Well, that sounds very complex, and model-driven decision support systems can be very complex mathematically. As I said, the key is to make sure that the users of the system understand the quantitative models that are part of the decision support system. The chapter goes over these 10, I believe there are 10, general model problem types. Cost-benefit analysis is where we enumerate the costs, both direct and indirect in a situation, and the benefits, and then we'll do things like calculate a cost-benefit ratio or some other kind of calculation like a payback. Forecasting is where we take a variable like sales and we estimate what sales will be based on some factors like amount of money we spend on advertising, and we try to forecast for a year or two or three years in advance, either for a specific product or group of products. Finance and investment, and the chapter talks about some of those models, but finance and investment might involve a stock portfolio, it might involve an interest rate to charge, so there could be a lot of different finance and investment models that we use. Inventory control and stockout, that may be an economic order quantity model. And you should have seen that in the tutorial that's due today. We worked with using Solver for inventory decisions. We had some constraints, and you actually then tried to figure out what the optimal number of refrigerators to order and stoves. So we were basically doing optimization for inventory control and to make sure we had enough inventory so that we could meet the demand for those appliances. Location, allocation, and distribution. Location means where do we want to have a factory located to meet demand or where we want to put a retail store. Allocation is how much product we want to allocate to stores or manpower that we want to put in our branches. But allocation is taking resources and we distribute them. Most of the time with allocation, we do try to do some kind of optimization. Distribution is similar to allocation, but we're trying to deal with finished goods that we want to either stage in warehouses or do other kinds of things. Manpower planning and assignment, that may be scheduling. We're trying to figure out how many nurses should work in a hospital for each shift and how to schedule them so that they get their days off and so that we have adequate coverage. We may look at how many people we need to hire in the organization to fill anticipated vacancies so that we go and recruit university students to come into the organization. So we can do decision support for those things. Project planning and control. We look at tasks that we need to do, how much time it's going to take, how much it'll cost, how many people need to work on them, and then maybe we follow up and we look at our Gantt charts or our project plans and we track project completion. Queuing and congestion, the easiest way to think about that is to look at teller lines at a bank. Queuing means how many people will have to wait and for how long. Congestion tells us how crowded it is in a certain area. So we might have some kind of a model that helps us decide how many tellers we need in a new bank or how many teller windows to have open on a given day based on historical data or how many checkout counters to have open at a supermarket. Those are all queuing and congestion problems. We want to try to keep the queue short so that people don't get discouraged or unhappy so they're at Walmart. We don't want somebody to be waiting in a long line to check out and they get discouraged and they leave their basket there and they walk out of the store. That happens when the queue is too long. So we may every day run a model that helps us determine how many checkout people to have on for every hour during the day. And that helps us decide on our staffing, but it also tells us how many checkout registers we'll have open at noon and at 1 o'clock. And then if we see we still have too much congestion, we pull flexible people away from stocking or something else and we open up another register. When we build a facility, we have to anticipate the maximum number of queues that we want to have to deal with maximum demand for that facility. Reliability and replacement. Reliability and replacement refers to the problem we have with products that fail. So if you buy a computer, you may have a warranty, a one-year warranty on that computer, or 90 days full replacement. 1 year parts and material, but you have to pay the labor. Those are the reliability and replacement policies. We need to think about how much to charge for an extended warranty. That's based on historical data we have on product failure and what it's going to cost us to service those people. So a decision support system could help us make decisions about warranties, how long to give a warranty, or how much to charge for an extended warranty for 2 years or 3 years. If we have lots of products, that decision support system may be used quite a bit as we reset or price our warranties. And then sequencing and scheduling, that may apply to a manufacturing environment where we're sequencing jobs, or again, scheduling can be related to that manpower assignment problem, but we don't always have to schedule people. We can schedule other kinds of things, like rooms in the building here. So we may have a decision support system to help us schedule rooms or schedule cars. If we have a fleet of cars or trucks, so we want to schedule pickups for our truck fleet. So we can do all sorts of different scheduling and sequencing tasks depending on our business. Many of these are operational level problem types. That is, we use the decision support system at the operations level in the business, but some of them we can move up to the management control level. And you should all remember from Chapter 3 that we have decision support at different levels. But these model-driven DSS tend to apply to the operations level, maybe operations control, maybe management control. Especially the resource allocation models tend to be at the management control level. All right, well, I covered a lot very quickly there, and you need to look at the book and make sure that you understand all of that terminology. And there are descriptions of each of those 10 problem types. I'm not going to expect you to have memorized them all, but you need to be familiar with those so that if I ask you about them, you would be able, in a short answer question, to talk a little bit about it, and that you've at least gained some familiarity with the wide variety of problems that we can build model-driven DSS for. And there is a very wide scope of problems. The chapter goes over break-even analysis, which basically is helping us look at a new product introduction and how many units we're going to need to sell to cover all our fixed and variable costs. You should have seen that. That's a financial model. Then budget models, pro forma, and ratio analysis. And ratio analysis might be used in merger and acquisition or in bank analysis to give a company a loan. We might have a program that gives us some ratios or other information. Decision analysis is a tool that we sometimes use. Basically, a decision analysis says, let's find some factors and we'll attach weights to them. And most of our decision analysis is multiple goals or multiple factors. Decision trees are another tool that we sometimes use, and there we're looking at some branching. We have sequential decisions that we need to make, and we try to help people make those sequential decisions. Slide 14, well, that's some advantages and disadvantages of decision trees. This is a web-based tool called Alia Think. And it's creating a hierarchical decision tree. Another tool similar to that is an analytical hierarchy. And it's trying to say, let's look at our objectives and then see what alternatives can help us meet those objectives, and we evaluate those alternatives on the objectives. And the chapter outlines a multiple-step view. This is an example of a web-based analytical hierarchy tool called WebHyper. Ignore slide 18. Influence diagrams are actually more of a tool for laying out what the model is. We don't use it as much in the model, so it helps us see the cause and effect relationships, but I'm not going to ask about that. Forecasting models, the chapter goes over judgment models, time series models. Regression and econometric models are the most complex. They're the most sophisticated, but the hardest for managers to understand. And if you're building a system with those, you need to get an expert to help on your team to build that model-driven DSS. Network and optimization models. The most common is a linear programming model, and you should review that terminology. Most quantitative courses like decision techniques will go over linear programming. The key thing to realize is that we do have an objective function and we're going to either minimize it or maximize it. The Appliance Mark tutorial that you should have all completed now involved optimizing the profit that we were going to get from storing refrigerators and other appliances in the warehouse, and so we had constraints, and a chief constraint was how much warehouse space we had and what the size was of the appliances, but we also had a budget constraint, how much money we could spend on inventory. There are some web-based tools, and we're getting more of those, but a lot of the solvers are desktop or client side solvers. When we do web-based, we may put things into a fairly mathematical formula like slide 22, where we maximize that equation minus x1 plus 2 times x2, where x1 and x2 are variables. But that's pretty cryptic, and managers are not going to work with that. So we need to think a lot about the user interface with optimization, and we don't want to use tools like LPSolve. Simulation models, becoming increasingly visual and more sophisticated. The idea of a simulation is that we want to recognize that situations are complex, and we want to try to model as much of that complexity as we can, and we try to bring in some probabilistic information about how many orders we'll receive, or how many customers are going to come to our branch office, or what the average cost is, price is going to be for a room in our hotel. But simulation models bring more reality into the situation. Some advantages of simulation, whether it's a Monte Carlo simulation with probability or a visual simulation, are that it's pretty easy to understand. We actually try to show people the flow of information in the system. So we might see orders coming into the system. We might see wait time while it's being manufactured or it's being somehow worked on in our organization. And then the time it takes to deliver it to the customer. Those may all be flows in our simulation model, and we try to show people. The model is, quote, simple in that it fits with the way the real world works. So you see an analog or an analogy between the real situation and the model that we're trying to use for prediction or forecasting. We can do what-if analysis, and that may be by changing the probability distributions, or we run the model multiple times, or we make incremental changes to model parameters. Some things we need to keep in mind is it's a lot of work to build a model, and we don't oftentimes have lots of reusable components, although we're getting more packages for modeling, so you may have a manufacturing modeling package where there are objects that are already there for things like inventory or for machines, and we can bring those into our visual model. Some disadvantages: we don't get an optimal or best solution. We see multiple outcomes and we see how likely they are in most cases, or we see one version of what might happen, and then we watch it multiple times. With visual simulation, we're oftentimes just watching the simulation over and over again with some incremental changes in parameters. It can be very slow and costly, and the solutions are not usually very transferable. The methodology: we do definition, we construct the simulation model. If you're going to do a visual simulation, I think you want to have managers as part of the development team, and then people who understand how to use the simulation modeling tool. There's a case study at DSS Resources. It uses a modeling tool called ProSim, and it's for a hospital day room. A hospital in North Dakota wanted to build a new day room for patients to come for outpatient treatment, so they built a model first. And they wanted to look at different loads in terms of patient load and what the flow of traffic might be there. And then they were hoping to turn that into a decision support system to track what was happening in the day room and make modifications. But they did a model for a special study. And lots of our simulation models are for special studies and not so much for decision support. We need to test and validate the model. Oftentimes in a special study, we design experiments, and then we conduct them, and then we evaluate the results. Now, it may be that if we're doing a bank simulation, that we run that simulation every Friday to help us with staffing for the next week. So the model changes based on historical information and then most recent information in terms of the amount of business we have at the bank, and that helps us change our teller workforce or the number of drive-up windows we're going to have open on a Saturday afternoon. So we may run that special study again and again. The example from Virtual Worlds is the West Palomar hospital simulation that Cisco paid for in Second Life. And they built an exact replica of what the new hospital is going to look like when it's built in 2011. And they actually have it so that surgeons can go in and do simulated surgery in the operating rooms, and they can get some feel for the layout of the operating room and how much room they'll have to walk around. They can bring patients into the reception area, and they can look at people coming into the queues where people sign in, and they can see what kind of congestion occurs. So a fairly realistic visual simulation is now possible in some of the virtual worlds. All right. Slide 27 summarizes the types. As far as spreadsheet history, there's an article at decisionsupportsystems.com on the history of personal computer-based spreadsheets, starting with VisiCalc in 1979. VisiCalc was the first spreadsheet. It ran on the Apple computer. So it was the first killer application. Bob Frankston and let's see, who was the other? If you go to dssresources.com, the article is in the article links, or you can see it on the home page, a brief history of spreadsheets, and you'll see a picture of the inventors of VisiCalc. Bob Frankston, he did the actual programming. Dan Bricklin was a Harvard MBA, and he came up with the concept, and they created that, and it ran on the Apple computer, and you can read a little bit about the history of that. The fellow that developed Lotus 1-2-3, Mitch Kapoor, he's actually the chairman of the board of Linden Research right now that's developing Second Life. So Mitch is a serial entrepreneur. And his venture capital firm put a lot of the money into Linden Research in the early days, which was 1999, Linden Research was formed. Second Life went on the network in 2003. But by 2006, they still only had 50,000 registered users. So it's increased a lot from 2006. Well, that's about it. Do look at the history of spreadsheets. End user built DSS, you're doing that with Excel, and Excel is a good tool for end user built model driven DSS. But all the concerns from Chapter 5 on having end users build decision support systems certainly carry over to end user built model driven DSS. A few quick questions. Major types of models, those are the 10. The advantages of developing and using models in a DSS is that we do get quantified results. So we're able to give quantitative forecasts for a bid amount. We're able to quantify what might happen in a situation. The role of statistical analysis in a DSS, statistical analysis tells us usually about the likelihood of outcomes, or it shows us things like means and standard deviations if we do a simulation. Are there any questions?